Welcome to the statewide conversation with Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, an opportunity to ask questions about Minnesota's response and plans during this COVID-19 pandemic. If you didn't get a chance to send or call in your question this week, you can email covid@ampers.org or call 612-562-9895. We're teaming up with community radio stations throughout the state in partnership with Ampers, Diverse Radio for Minnesota Communities, and the Minnesota Broadcasters Association to bring you COVID-19 information for the state of Minnesota. I'm Heidi Holt, and I'm live from the KEXE studios. I'm in downtown Grand Rapids, Minnesota. We're going to be talking with Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. She's running a little bit late this morning. We have had a big week in the state of Minnesota. Today is Juneteenth, and we celebrate that. We've also had a memorial for the three men that 100 years ago on Monday, June 15th, were lynched in the city of Duluth, on the streets of Duluth, for a crime that they did not commit. The governor and lieutenant governor, as well as Keith Ellison, were there. Pardoned was Max Mason. He was one of those six African Americans that was arrested for the crime that they did not commit. We remember Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee. Those were the three men. And that memorial is in downtown Duluth. Today there is a peaceful protest there. It begins at 4 o'clock with a walk down to the waterfront. Also this week, the politics of special session as the Minnesota legislature talks about funding for COVID-19 as well as police reform. Today may or may not be the final day of the special session, and we will be finding out more as we follow through. You can keep updated by watching. I know one of the sources I go to for the Minnesota legislature is Almanac. You can catch that on Twin Cities Public Television on Friday evenings. Coming up will be Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. Thanks so much for sending in your questions this week. If you've missed our other conversations, whether it was with the Lieutenant Governor or some of the officials from the Minnesota Department of Health, you can catch up on those at our website, kaxe.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more questions and answers as we wait for Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. Most of you probably have seen her in a lot of those press conferences. She's very busy. We're glad to have her with us most weeks here as we all kind of work together to understand the pandemic of COVID-19 in the state of Minnesota. I took a look at the numbers that came out from the Minnesota Department of Health earlier today. It looks like we have gone up slightly in the confirmed cases across the state, 32,031 positive tests of COVID-19, and deaths in the state are at 1,361, with an additional probable 32 deaths. You can find lots of information at the dashboard at the Minnesota Department of Health. Some of the things going on across the region, the Attorney General's office reminds us to beware of COVID-19 scams that are happening by phone, robocalls, and text messages. You may be getting something that's offering free home testing kits or promoting coronavirus cures, selling health insurance, offering free services, or impersonating government offices. You can hear call examples and find out what to look for at fcc.gov/COVID-scams. Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan is joining us now. Thanks for being here. Happy Juneteenth to you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me again, Heidi. Happy Juneteenth to you as well. The governor just signed a proclamation, and we are asking the legislature to make Juneteenth an official holiday in the state of Minnesota.
Oh, that's great. Well, it was another big week in Minnesota. We had a commemoration on Monday of the lynching of the three African-American men. It was 100 years ago. We're also right in the heat of the politics of special session. So before we get to the questions, I'm wondering, how was your week? What were some of the things that you were concentrating on?
Sure. So that centennial was a really important moment in Minnesota history. And I think you know, the governor and the pardon board issued a pardon to Max Mason, who was one of the African American men who was arrested for the rape of a white woman, and he was pardoned on Friday, and then we had the centennial, and the governor and first lady went up to Duluth and acknowledged that moment. And I was really struck by the images as well of the signs and folks who had gathered to also honor the memory and call for justice for George Floyd. So if I'm really honest, that has been the focus of my week, and the governor's week has really been working in partnership with the People of Color and Indigenous Caucus to move the police accountability and reform package through the legislature. The Senate heard a handful of bills that are fairly weak in comparison to the House package. And last night I stayed up till the wee hours of the morning in solidarity with my former colleagues of the People of Color and Indigenous Caucus in the House and watched them pass a really powerful package that was created in partnership with the community, with Attorney General Ellison and Commissioner Harrington on their use of excessive force task force recommendations. And when you center the people who are most impacted, I think you can get some different results. So I hope the Senate takes up the challenge and passes the House package today. It's on their desk, and they certainly could take action, and I think Minnesotans are ready for that.
Well, one of the questions that we got that came in this week had to do with the disparities between different racial and ethnic groups when it comes to COVID-19, and they wanted some clarification. Why is there that disparity?
Well, that's a really big question, and I think, you know, it's a good question, especially in this moment, and I want to be really clear that, you know, this has nothing to do with the biological differences and everything to do with the entrenched racism and you know, poverty, and frankly, the foundation on which Minnesota was formed and founded, and it's been going on for generations. And so many of the disparities that currently exist are due to policies of redlining, of underfunding communities, and structures that perpetuate and frankly benefit white Minnesotans without taking into account that there are people of color, Indigenous folks, immigrants, and refugees who also make up the fabric of the state of Minnesota. And so one thing that we know for sure is that you're more likely to have serious symptoms of COVID-19 if you have underlying conditions like high blood pressure, asthma, diabetes, and many others. So, you know, Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities have much higher rates of these underlying conditions because they're less likely to have comprehensive or culturally appropriate health care where they live. They might not have access to health insurance or for any number of reasons. And so because we have these higher rates of underlying conditions in our communities, in my community as well, in the Native community, we see higher rates of severe symptoms from COVID-19. And when we first issued the stay-at-home order, we also designated certain professions as essential, jobs that need to be done in person during the pandemic. So things like healthcare workers or like grocery store employees. And many of these essential jobs, the folks who we believe to be essential, especially low-wage service jobs, are filled by people of color and Indigenous folks who, frankly, just by the act of doing these jobs, it puts them at a greater risk of exposure. So there are structures that are putting communities of color at risk that are economic, they are resource-based, and they're historical policies. They are not biological. But I would also say that, like, these are some of the things that we are trying to correct now in partnership with the legislature. And I think I keep coming back to the moment when George Floyd called out for his mother, and that felt like a moment where things shifted. And my hope is that we can push our notion of Minnesota nice aside in this this time, which too often I think means that we don't address the real issue, which is systemic racism, and just name it racism, that will help us to undo some of the structures that are perpetuating the higher impacts of COVID-19 on communities of color, but also on a whole host of other measures where people of color face incredible disparities in this state.
You know, it's hard to say like there's any silver lining or to what we have been going through when it comes to COVID-19 or the death of George Floyd, but we certainly are seeing the disparities, and we're seeing the systems that aren't fair in a way that I don't think everybody saw before.
That's right. And I think there's many of us, myself included, who've been working on these issues I've been working on them for about 20 years, and I know that there are people whose shoulders I am standing upon who have also been fighting these fights. And you know, I go back to a conversation that I had with Valerie Castile, the mother of Philando Castile, and she said, you know, God sent you Philando, but it wasn't enough. And now God sent you George Floyd, and he's got to be enough. And, you know, I think that is the moment in which we find ourselves, that things have shifted. We are having difficult conversations and things are breaking in front of us, right? But that's a good thing, because when things are broken, that's how the light gets in, and we're able to then deal with these issues that frankly aren't just Twin City issues. It's not just an issue in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but these are deep issues all across the state of Minnesota.
You are listening to the statewide conversation with Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. So we've got some questions to get to about our elders and education. Let's start with the education questions. The state just put out some guidance that schools need to plan for three different back-to-school approaches. And the question is, how much variety do you think there will be from school to school? Who's going to make those final decisions? And what if the administrators don't agree with state government officials?
Sure. So we continue to monitor how the virus is spreading currently and how it will spread later into the summer and fall. And we know that there's a compounding effect with the flu season that occurs every year. And so there's the variety will certainly depend on localized community spread. And we've seen some counties become hotspots across the state, where others fortunately like haven't seen as much. So the Department of Health and the Department of Education are still working on who will make those determinations. But again, it will be based on public health data at the local, regional, and state level. There's also guidance that if a student is medically fragile, in a vulnerable population, or doesn't have the confidence in returning, that schools should honor that decision and provide distance learning and support for that student. So the public health of students and families and staff should be at the top of mind for administrators, when analyzing the health data and the plans that they're developing for folks to go back to school. So scenarios that they employ will be dependent on a variety of factors, and school communities will be deeply part of developing those individual plans. And Heidi, as a mom of a second grader, I am also really feeling this urgency. But also as the mom of a kiddo with an underlying condition, I want to make sure that, you know, we are doing this in a very thoughtful way with the most up-to-date data that we possibly can. So the reason that we released those three scenarios was really to say, we want you to be intentional and planful, because, you know, COVID-19 we're still learning about it. And so we need to be prepared, for whatever we face in the fall.
We heard from a listener in Minneapolis who asked about the schools opening back up and whether the state has considered aid for schools. Cleaning and extra supplies will likely inflate budgets that are already shrinking. Can the state do anything about that? Many schools don't have extra money.
Sure. So this is a good question. And, you know, as a former school board member, like I certainly feel this, that you have to to deal with a lot of the decisions that are made at the federal and state level and then come down to the local district. And so, you know, we are really grateful for the legislature codifying the fund transfers that the governor included in his executive orders on distance learning. And so this allowed districts and charter schools to be flexible and move their funds around since they use buses and technology more and like business building lights less with the students who are not in the buildings themselves. So Minnesota also received some federal funding that will go directly to school districts to address the things that you're talking about. So we expect districts are also going to think about technology access, summer school, and something we are hearing increasingly is mental health support for students and their families. So we're exploring some other options too, and the federal funding, because these pots may not be enough. The CDC said school buses should only be half full, for example. So that may require extra funding to be able to meet the transportation needs to get students to and from school. And cleaning is another, since our guidance lays out expanded cleaning practices that, you know, should be followed and required, and we know that those will take additional resources. We want to work with the congressional delegation to try to secure additional funding for our schools. Some of that money has come in, and I think we've got a little bit more to go.
We had another question that came in about education, but this time about higher ed. The University of Minnesota announced its plans for fall and how they'll welcome back students on campus. And a bunch of other colleges have followed suit. The listener said, I cannot imagine that college kids are going to keep up all these social distancing rules and wearing masks. Are there plans to do regular mass testing with college kids? And do we even have that kind of capacity in the state of Minnesota?
Well, you know, institutions of higher education have been working really closely with our Department of Health and the Office of Higher Education to develop preparedness plans for each campus and each college and university. So these plans account for everything that goes on around campus. So that's classrooms, outdoor spaces, libraries, residence halls, fitness centers, dining halls. You name it, all the spaces where students are and where faculty are. And so we're actively planning on how we will both modify our testing strategy when students return to in-person classes, the best way to deploy testing for those campuses, and how testing would inform our decisions on what in-person settings are safe. So in-person classes, social events, sporting events, dormitory life, that type of thing. And we have a strong capacity to do more widespread testing now, and we are in constant communication with the federal government, testing suppliers, and our healthcare systems to be sure that our testing capacity remains strong. So those conversations will be ongoing, and I think, you know, until we have a vaccine, I think our way of life is going to change for a while. I will tell you that, you know, I am, the governor and I will be tested on a regular basis as we are going about the state and needing to do this business. And I think that Minnesotans should also get used to that testing will likely be part of our regular life, and it should be as well for students.
Okay, let's move on to some of the questions we got about our elders this week. There was a confidential question that came in directly to you. It said, Dear Lieutenant Governor, I think it is cruel to not let people who have lived long lives get to see their family members during these scary times. Between the pandemic and the riots, I don't know what else can help an elder than being around loved ones. Makes me so sad and angry at the same time. I can barely even speak about it, but I'm sending you this email to express myself, and I thank you for addressing it.
This is something for me that is really personal. And Heidi, we have talked about my mom before. My mom has several underlying conditions, and I haven't seen her for months. And normally, my daughter goes to grandma's house at least once a week, and we see each other on a regular basis, bring groceries, and visit. And we haven't been able to do that, and it has been incredibly painful for all of us. But staying away from my mom is one of the ways that I can show her how much I love her. and that we have to make these really incredibly difficult decisions right now, because what we are seeing is that our elders and our loved ones who are in nursing home facilities are also at higher risk. And so this is, we know how important it is for people to see their family members, and we know how important just even the act of physical touch or, you know, holding someone's hand and embrace is to just our overall mental health and well-being. But we also know that those are the things that can very much be what transfers and infects someone with COVID-19. So we are continuing to understand how it spreads, best practices to prevent contagion, which, you know, has helped us to develop this guidance so we can balance all of those aspects of someone's health, including social well-being. But it's hard, and I don't, you know, I'm angry too. I'm angry that I can't see my mom, and I'm angry that I'm also angry, frankly, that the federal government hasn't done enough either. And so we are battling this in many ways without the support of a coordinated effort coming out of Washington. I just feel that, and I don't have a better answer for you other than that continues to put our elders at risk. It is one of the cruelest things about COVID-19, but our response is also one of the kindest things that we can do to keep people alive. And so whatever we can do to call our elders, to visit in a way that could be socially distanced on the other side of a window. My mom and I have conversations where she's a floor up on her balcony and I'm on the phone and she's on the phone. Sending a handwritten note or letter. My mom and I have been mailing each other cards. There are different strategies that we have to use to stay connected in this moment. And just please rest assured that, you know, we will continue to do everything that we can to protect our elders from COVID-19. And I'm sorry that this is one of the things that is required in this moment.
Before we go, a couple of the questions that came in kind of had to do with that psychological side of living through a pandemic. One question was, do you think COVID brain is a real thing? Their coworkers believe that.
So I don't know that I've ever heard of COVID brain, to be honest with you. I've certainly had pregnancy brain. I know what that is. But I do know that people are experiencing just additional stress and fatigue, and those things can certainly impact your overall mental health and well-being. For folks who are working from home, I think one of the things that has just been really clear is that people are actually working more at home than they were working when they were at work. And so that feels like you can't ever turn it off. And for folks who are going to a workplace every day, what we're also finding is that, you know, those folks are working longer hours, and just the stress of continuing to stay safe by frequent hand washing, wearing masks and other things. And, those are all incredibly, incredibly stressful. And so I feel that, and would just encourage people, to determine, like, when can you turn it off? When can you, take care of yourself and take care of your spirit in this moment? I think it becomes even more important, and especially as we are still in the very recent traumatic experience that folks saw, not just in this state, but all across the world, of watching the murder of George Floyd in the aftermath. I would also say that people of color, indigenous folks, the black community, are experiencing an additional sense of fatigue in this moment. And so it is just really important to take care of yourself and check on each other and do what you can in this moment to give yourself space to process and to check out for a little bit if you need to.
We had a listener who wanted to know how you are combating pandemic fatigue, and it sounds like part of it might be finding different ways to connect with your mom, but mm-hmm. How else are you dealing with it?
So, I wish, Heidi, I wish I could tell you that I was a better model for self-care than I am. But, you know, some of the things that have been important to our family is just continuing to go outside, you know, to spend that time socially distancing in our yard with a friend, and trying to do those things. And also just knowing that, you know, also just knowing that there are tools. We've talked about this before, but, you know, the arts, music, writing, and just spending time with my kid. And I sort of have forgotten. I you know, keep the news on all the time, or, you know, have the radio on, and that is very important, Heidi, your, you know, ampers and everyone else, right? But also just remembering that there are radio stations and there are that play music, and that, you know, we can also find that time. I've been, you know, just trying to listen to music for at least like a half hour every day, and it has totally changed my mood and allows me just a second to really breathe and then come back to it. So those are some of the things that I do. And of course, I, you know, already confessed that I enjoy reality television, and, you know, watch Married at First Sight and other programs like that that, you know, don't require a lot of brain space. My husband, to relax, really enjoys documentaries, and I just can't get down with that right now because I feel like we are living a documentary. So I like to check out with a little reality TV.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm a Top Chef just ended last night, and that was a really nice thing to be watching.
Yep.
Well, have you, one of our new favorite albums around here that just came out is by Minnesotan Jaya Sundara has a new one out that he wrote during the pandemic. Have you checked that out yet?
I have not. I will certainly put it on my list. I love listening to new music, and especially by Minnesota artists, because we have... we've got a lot of talent in this state.
Yeah. He's got a song on there called Mr. Landlord, and it's about, you know, he lives in Northeast Minneapolis and how these times it's really tough to be paying all your bills.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, if I can't just bring it back to the legislative session for a second, that's a nice segue because, you know, we are worried about, you know, folks who haven't been able to pay their rent or to make their mortgage payments. And there's an opportunity for the legislature to also take action and provide some relief for folks through housing assistance so that, you know, as we're asking people to stay safe and to stay home, that they can have a home to continue to stay in. And that's really just critical in this moment because COVID brain, you know, now I guess I'll adopt some of that language, right, is also, I think, in addition to just worrying about the pandemic, is the impact of the pandemic on people's livelihoods and the economy. And that is something that is incredibly, incredibly stressful that, you know, we're thinking about in this moment, too.
That's Minnesota's Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan. We thank you, as always, for your time and hope you have a great week.
Thanks so much, Heidi. Take good care.
You too. This broadcast, a collaboration of community radio stations throughout the state, in partnership with Amper's Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities and the Minnesota Broadcasters Association. You can listen to this full conversation at kaxe.org. If you have a question, you can email covid@ampers.org or call 612-562-9895. I'm Heidi Holton for KAXE, KBXE. Thanks for listening.